Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a new study suggests spraying aerosols into the atmosphere could actually help reduce climate change.
If the world's nations cannot come to some kind of agreement, we get into a scenario where this is by far the lesser of the many evils that are available to us.
Also today, former federal judge Nancy Gertner on Paul Manafort's 47-month sentence.
And what the judge essentially did is to say this was no big deal. Somehow it would be a bigger deal if Manafort had distributed crack in quantities, which of course makes no sense whatsoever.
And the Atlantic magazine says Suffolk County is the most politically intolerant place in the nation. We'll debate the charge.
If Boston wants to be full of ideas, it needs to ask itself how open it is to ideas.
Also today, we'll have the latest on the leadership change here at WBUR. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. And we begin today with news from within WBUR. General Manager Charlie Kravitz is leaving the station. Today, meeting with WBUR's staff, leadership from Boston University, which owns the station's broadcast license, said he would not return for day-to-day management and would officially step down on June 30th. This comes less than 2 weeks after journalists at WBUR voted overwhelmingly to unionize and 1 year after the high-profile firing of former On Point host Tom Ashbrook. For more, we turn to WBUR's Martha Bieminger. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm all right. I should say, Martha, this is a tough day, obviously, and tough for you to report on your own workplace, but we do believe in full transparency here. And you've been reporting on this story from Tom Ashbrook. You've been looking at workplace culture, unionization efforts, and I know that you've been kind of siloed with two editors to make sure that there is journalistic integrity and full transparency there. So with that out of the way, can you give us a little context here? Why is Charlie Kravitz leaving WBUR?
Well, Charlie Kravitz is seen as a visionary at WBUR. He is also seen as someone who could be a micromanager and somewhat difficult to work with for some people in the station. There are really mixed reactions today, I would say, Chris. Many people are sad to see that Charlie is leaving. Many people wonder if new leadership will do even more great things for the station.
So I have to be blunt here. Was he fired?
BU leadership says no. The station was briefed by Gary Nixa, who's the senior vice president of operations at Boston University. He said that it was a matter of timing, that it was about the unionization vote that was on February 27th. We have city space opening, so we have some of Mr. Kravitz's great visions coming to fruition at the same time that we see a vote by members of the journalist community here at WBUR who did not think that his leadership was necessarily going to do the best thing for the station. But here's a little bit from Gary Nixa.
We focused this past week on the question of how to move forward and came to this conclusion that it would be the time to make this transition. And that was a joint decision.
They did issue a joint statement, Chris. That's Charlie Kravitz and the BU leaders. But many people at the meeting today pointed out that, as far as they know, Charlie was still moving forward full speed with many of his big ideas. So it's not clear that he's would have left if somebody hadn't come and spoken to him.
Yeah. Worth pointing out, Charlie was not at that meeting this morning.
He was not at that meeting.
I was there, but if you could give our listeners a sense of kind of how this news was received by folks here at the station.
There was a lot of shock and surprise, many questions about whether some of the plans that Charlie had laid out would continue, what the search process would be like. A big question was why Charlie wasn't in the room, as you just mentioned. And it's not clear. That does seem like a fairly unusual move. As far as we know, he's not supposed to be coming in and out of the building at will right now. Many people talked about his accomplishments and the things that he's done for the station. One of them was Meghna Chakrabarty, the host of On Point, who talked about the ways that Charlie has kept this station strong when many other media outlets have been struggling.
we're bucking the trend. This is a great place to work. We've had our ups and downs for sure, but it's a healthy journalistic organization, and I would credit Charlie Kravitz for leading the way on that.
So some of those items, Chris, we've talked about city space. He expanded the staff and the physical space within which the staff works, added environmental units and investigative reporting units. A lot of accomplishments.
I want to point out, Radio Boston listeners will recognize that voice. She also hosted this show for
sure.
A long time. What else are you hearing from BU's leadership on this transition?
Well, they do say that they are grateful to Charlie. We heard Gary Nixa say a little bit more about that in the meeting.
We really appreciate everything that Charlie has done for the station and the university. We give him tremendous credit. I mean, it was part of a team effort that he led. I wish him well, you know, as he moves forward. And I want the station to know that the university fully supports what it is doing, and we're here to help.
They talk about a nationwide search that will begin pretty much immediately. They're looking for someone to lead that. It is supposed to include members of the staff as well as the board of overseers, some people from BU outside the organization as well. So there's a sense that they know they need to do something very quickly. There was a long delay after a former investigation of culture at the station that may have contributed to some of the frustration here at the station, and I think there's a strong commitment not to repeat that.
So I should mention that we here at Radio Boston reach out to BU leadership, and they referred us to that statement that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a ton to that statement. It's pretty short. It says basically, quote, during Mr. Kravitz's 8 years as general manager of WBUR, the station's staff, reputation, digital platforms, and commitment to news and community engagement have grown to unprecedented levels. We also reached out to Charlie, haven't heard back from him. Can you give us a sense of what he did actually accomplish here with some concrete examples?
Well, Meghana Chakrabarty, who we just talked about, started that job as host of Radio Boston, the show that we're on now, right about the time that Charlie started, and she felt he really supported the development of the individuals on that show as well as the show itself. Here and Now, which is WBUR's midday show, expanded to 2 hours and partnered with NPR to become their national midday show under Charlie's tenure. He started a diversity initiative that's still underway here at the station. We've talked about city space. We've talked about some of the additional local news coverage. There's a very healthy list of things that he's done to grow this station, which was already had a very strong reputation, but has really become very well respected on the national landscape.
Yeah. On the flip side, there's also been some turbulence over the last year. We've had the investigation into the workplace culture here at WBUR after we mentioned the high-profile firing of Tom Ashbrook. Can you remind our listeners kind of the context of what's gone on in the past year or so?
Tom Ashbrook was dismissed in February of last year. That launched an investigation of station culture, included interviews with many people at the station in a report that was not seen by the staff as a whole, but we understand included the need to really make major changes in five areas. The general manager's office was one of those. There's a steering committee that didn't start meeting until December of last year that is supposed to be implementing an action plan that came out of that. In the midst of all of that, Chris, we had this bid to form a union, which was approved very overwhelmingly, 73-3 in late February.
All right. That's WBUR's Martha Biebinger. Martha, thanks so much.
Thank you, Chris.
For more on what comes next here at WBUR, let's turn now to Sam Fleming. He's currently WBUR's Director of News and Programming and has been appointed by Boston University to manage the station and oversee its operation until a new general manager is named. Sam, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
So you've worked with Charlie for his tenure here at the station, and as Martha kind of laid out there, there have been a lot of accomplishments. Why is this move the right move here for WBUR?
Well, I came in late to the didn't learn about it much before you did, Chris. I think that I'm mostly focused on stabilizing the situation and continuing to do the kind of work that I know that our listeners care passionately about, including listening to this very broadcast and more, you know, all of the different programs. And you mentioned one of the accomplishments, Martha, that I wanted to echo, which was, you know, the Here and Now one, working with NPR. NPR's never had a partnership, editorial partnership like that. This happened soon after Charlie came in where he recognized a need for a midday presence, and the timing was just right with one of his former colleagues at NPR, Kinsey Wilson, and this came about. And it's now, I think, really one of the, you know, maybe the third most important program in all of public radio. So in many ways, that in and of itself is a huge accomplishment. City Space, of course, is the latest important endeavor. And I think we're just getting that started. So I think it's going to be interesting to see where that goes. I think the momentum of the first month or two, you know, shows it's got an amazing amount of momentum and potential. As you know, I know Radio Boston did a program down there. So Charlie, as Martha said, has got us on the right course in many, many different tracks. And now it's important that we stabilize the situation and, you know, find a great new leader and basically move forward in strategic ways, because the media landscape's changing, as you know. And it's very important for us to not sit there and tread water. We need to keep pushing forward, something that Charlie did fervently with passion every day.
And to that note, are there any specific changes you see kind of coming in the future, or things that you hope the new general manager will work on?
Well, I don't think there's anything obvious, but I think as an example, just knowing how important it is for us to get our broadcast side, which has always been the side that is most of our listeners have cared about and probably brought in the bacon, so to speak, raising money. It's important that our digital side evolve in the same way. But these are issues that are happening at NPR and public radio stations all across America. And so I think we need to be strategic. We need to keep forward the momentum that Charlie started in his strategic plan FutureCast, and we have to make sure that we keep moving forward.
So you mentioned kind of public radio writ large. I'm wondering if you could give us a little context of kind of the larger public media landscape. WNYC and NPR National have both had their own issues. Laura Walker is resigning at WNYC. At NPR, Chief Yarol Mohn is resigning. Now Charlie Kravitz. Do you see this as kind of a system?
I know Los Angeles, too. I know. Yeah. I was actually just talking about it. You know, the five stations, I think, in the top 10 markets.
I mean, that's pretty staggering. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I it may be partly a coincidence and partly a shift in the political and media landscape and the landscape within public media, which I think we've all seen with the Me Too movement. I think we had obviously a very difficult situation here in the aftermath of the Tom Ashbrook situation. NPR had a similar situation happen there. New York had a similar situation happen there. And I think our audience is changing. I think the people that work in our buildings are becoming more diverse and are representing America in a better way. And so I just think it's a turbulent time in our business. And we need to, you know, keep being as strong within the leadership of the WBUR has provided in the public radio landscape as we have in the past that Martha alluded to.
All right, last question. I'll let you off the hook here. Can you tell us anything about the search for the new general manager and what can we expect in terms of the process and specifically transparency?
I really don't know any more than what you heard, which is it's going to be a national search. Apparently, there's going to be a national journalism person of some sort who's going to lead it. And there are going to be some representatives within the station. I think maybe up to 9 is what I've heard on the search committee. And, you know, that all sounds good to me. And I know that this is one of the places that would be an amazing place for any general manager to work. You know, the staff, the audience. I mean, what an incredible market that we're all privileged to work in here in Boston. And so I would presume that we would have incredibly great applicants. And it'll be hard steps to follow in, but I think, you know, WBUR has evolved over 30 years, and we have to just keep making sure that we continue to push forward the way we have.
WBUR Director of News and Programming Sam Fleming, he's been appointed by the university to manage the station and oversee its operation until a new general manager is named. Sam, thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, it may sound like an idea out of a science fiction movie, spraying aerosols into the atmosphere to reflect sunlight and cool the Earth. But a new study by scientists at MIT, Harvard, and Princeton says the process, called solar geoengineering, may actually be a cheap and effective way to reduce the impacts of global climate change. Carrie Emanuel is a professor of atmospheric science at MIT and a co-author of the study, and he spoke with us earlier today. I started by asking him to explain what solar geoengineering is actually all about.
Well, that's an attempt to counter some of the adverse effects of global warming by putting material into the stratosphere to reflect sunlight and to try to cool the planet back down.
So, and I know that there are two components to solar geoengineering. There's also efforts being researched to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. Why did you guys decide to focus purely on the aerosols?
Well, because it's cheap and doable. So let me explain. The most straightforward and least risky approach is just to take the carbon dioxide back out. And the only problem with that is it's very, very expensive to do right at the moment. There is some hope of driving that price down, but right at the moment, it's just not economical to do it. Whereas what we call solar radiation management, another form of geoengineering, is very, very cheap to do, but it is also riskier.
Okay, so you say in the study that this isn't something that's going to completely reverse global climate change. It's not going to bring temperatures back to where they were pre-industrial revolution. What did you guys actually find in your research?
Well, you can actually dial the temperature back as pretty much as far as you like, but the main conclusion of our work is that when you do that, the global rainfall and other patterns are not going to be back to their pre-industrial values. So what we looked at in this paper is what happens if you just scale back half the temperature increase that's owing to global warming and look at the other variables like precipitation, storminess, and so on.
So I'm sure there are a ton of variables to consider when you're talking about something of this kind of scope. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you built this model, what kind of factors you considered? And I mean, you're talking about shifting weather patterns. How do you factor everything in and make sure that you've got everything kind of on the table?
Well, you know, you're never going to be absolutely certain about anything having to do with future climates. It involves complex modeling, and you just have to do the best you can. But there's some very, very basic physics operating here. So here's the story. When you put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you're changing the balance of infrared radiation. Carbon dioxide absorbs infrared radiation and re-radiates some of that back to the Earth. That's what we call the greenhouse effect. The solar radiation management that we're talking about in the paper operates on the solar part of the spectrum, the sunlight. You can make it a zero-sum game for temperature. That is, you can block enough sunlight so that the global mean temperature returns to, let's say, pre-industrial values. But you won't be zero-sum in a lot of other quantities, and the most important one is rainfall. So if you dial it all the way back, you're going to actually end up with less rain globally than you had in the pre-industrial era. So our strategy was to dial half of it back, in which case that does return rainfall globally to more or less what it was before we started changing the greenhouse effect.
This sounds like it could be very promising, obviously, and climate change is a major issue that we're going to have to figure out. There's no such thing as a magic bullet, as we all know. Are you worried at all as this research moves forward that there are going to be inevitably unforeseen consequences to some of these attempted solutions?
Well, yes, I'm worried, but I actually think the best preventative medicine is to understand this through research as well as we can. Let me explain that this is so cheap that a single small country or even a single very wealthy individual could carry it out. If you encourage that by your ignorance of it, if we can't say definitively why you shouldn't do that, there's not going to be very much to stop such a small country or an individual. But if you really have a better handle of what some of the side effects will be, and there will be some bad side effects, we hope most of the outcome will be good, then you're going to make it actually, I think, less likely to happen, at least not by a single country or an individual, because they're wide open to criticism, lawsuits, and so forth.
So that's obviously a terrifying scenario, some wealthy individual or some individual nation deciding they're going to launch something into the atmosphere that ends up having devastating effects for everyone.
Yes.
But doesn't this research kind of make that more appealing if you're saying, hey, this is a solution that could work as long as you think about this and these factors, this could potentially be a solution for climate change. Isn't that encouraging countries and individuals to try to take part in something like this?
I think you might look at it this way. It might very well be encouraging for a consortium of countries under some nearly global agreement. It would be discouraging for individual countries or individual people, simply because anything you do to change the climate is going to have a spectrum effect. You can't think of this as all good or all bad. It's like life. You know, there's some good and there's some bad. You hope if you decide to do this, it's going to be mostly good. But even if that's true, there'll be some bad side effects. If you're an individual or a small country, you're wide open to being sued by people who said, well, the scientists said there'd be these bad side effects. Here they are, and we're going after you. So I am of the opinion, and I think my fellow co-authors share that opinion, that you're much better off operating from a state of as much knowledge as you can gain on the subject, and there's nothing to be gained by remaining ignorant of it. We know enough about it and have for some years that you can do this fairly cheaply, and as long as that finding is out there, we're better off knowing more than less.
So what would you say is your major takeaway from this study?
Well, I see it, as a scientist sees it, as a step to really getting a handle on some of the costs and benefits of doing this. If the world's nations cannot come to some kind of agreement about curbing greenhouse emissions, we get into a scenario where this is by far the lesser of the many evils that are available to us. It's sort of like an emergency alarm that you would sound, or something you'd keep in your back pocket to play if things got desperate. That's the way I look at it. But I don't think it's the best way forward. I don't think my co-authors believe that. What we really ought to do is get a handle on greenhouse gases.
That's Kerry Emanuel, professor of atmospheric science at MIT. The study he co-authored on solar geoengineering is out today in the journal Nature Climate Change. Kerry, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, former federal judge Nancy Gertner on Paul Manafort's 47-month sentence and what to expect at his second and final sentencing hearing this Wednesday. I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. On Wednesday, Paul Manafort will be back in court for a second round of sentencing. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson could give Manafort a maximum of 10 years for conspiracy against the U.S. and conspiracy to obstruct justice. And all eyes will be on that proceeding after last week, when Manafort received a sentence of just 47 months in prison for tax and financial fraud charges. That's well below the 19 to 24 years recommended by federal guidelines. Joining me now to talk about all of this is Judge Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. And she wrote all about this in an op-ed for The Washington Post titled, U.S. Sentencing Needs Reform, but Manafort's 47 months was a strange one. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
So I think it's fair to say that the sentence last week shocked a lot of people in the legal community, not just yourself. In the New York Times, William Nettles, he's a former U.S. attorney in South Carolina, called this decision sentencing disparity on steroids. What do you make of the sentence?
Well, I think that the it is unusual. It was unusual for this judge. I did a little bit of work before I wrote that op-ed, and this is not a judge who is wont to give anything other than a strict guideline sentence for white-collar offenders and for poor people and people of color. So that this was unusual, and you have to sort of step back and say, what was it about the case that made it unusual? What made Manafort, remarkably deserving of a different sentence? Let me just put a footnote there. We are all looking through this through the lens of an incredibly punitive system. So when we say he just got 4 years, people around the world would say just, that's a lot.
Yeah, especially for a 69-year-old.
But still, what was it about it that was remarkable? And not much, in my view, was remarkable that would have justified that kind of a sentence.
So I'm curious if you can give us some context for kind of how outside the norms a sentence like this actually is. Doing some reading on this. On one hand, you have folks like Kenneth White. He's a former federal prosecutor, now a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles. He told Business Insider that while this was unusual, it wasn't unheard of. He said, quote, it's more like a 10%er rather than a 1%er. In terms of judges departing from the guidelines. On the other hand, you've got the New York Times reporting that in 4 out of 5 criminal cases, the sentence falls within or above the guidelines. So I'm curious, in your experience, how closely do judges follow sentencing guidelines?
Well, the Sentencing Commission has statistics that suggest that they follow it in 80% of the cases. Now, 80% needs to be unpacked. That usually is 50% of the time the judges follow the guidelines, and then 30% of the time they will go lower where the government seeks a lower sentence. So that's how you get the 80% figure, which when you step back is really troubling, right? That somehow the government has to bless a judge's discretion. But put that aside. So this is unusual in general, given the fact that there's that much guideline compliance. It wasn't unusual in this particular case because the guidelines were nuts. There's no question about it. 19 to 24 years for a 69-year-old man was nuts, and was really because the guidelines, you know, tally up the amount of money that was involved in the case without looking at it, just about anything else. So that it was going to be lower than that guideline was not a surprise to me at all, that the judge would take into account his age was not a surprise. What was a surprise was that essentially I think he knowingly gave the sentence that a cooperator might get in this case. And that what the judge, you know, sentencing, they say, sends a message. Usually the message is a general deterrence one. Don't do this again, anybody who's thinking of doing it. I was worrying that the message this judge was sending was, hey, special prosecutor, hey, all of you, this is no big deal. And that would be a troubling message.
Sure, especially with another sentencing proceeding coming up this week. I'm curious, you've done a lot of work with mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses. You've talked about your experience as a judge being kind of torn at some of the sentences you were forced to give. I've called them unfair, disproportionate. Can you talk a little bit about sentencing from a bigger picture?
Well, we are the most punitive West country in the Western world. We were basically, since the 1980s, our imprisonment rate has skyrocketed. We imprison more people than any other Western country, and we imprison certainly disproportionately people of color. So there's no question that the system has to be transformed so that we are not regarding prison as the only alternative for everything. We now know so much more about what we can do with people in terms of addiction, in terms of psychological issues. So we should be ratcheting down. There's no question about it, all across the country, in this state as well. Just going back to Manafort, the problem was that this is sort of an odd case to begin the ratchet, given the circumstances.
Yeah, especially... Sorry, go ahead.
No, but you know, that there is 80% of the sentences that I entered as a judge were disproportionate and unfair and unjust.
Yeah, and I was struck seeing some of the stories and the perspectives of folks who had kind of a comparison to offer. Scott Hechinger, a public defender in Brooklyn, tweeted about this case, quote, for context on Manafort's 47 months in prison, my client yesterday was offered 36 to 72 months in prison for stealing $100 worth of quarters from a residential laundry room. I mean, that's a pretty stark comparison. How do you see that and not look at our justice system cynically?
Well, that's right, because essentially long sentences, it was as if, you know, the old saw that to a hammer everything looks like a nail. It was like the only thing that we were looking at was imprisonment for everything. It was a sort of wave of retributive impulses that swept across the country. No, I sentenced men, you know, one guy I'm writing about, actually, whom I sentenced to a 10-year sentence for distributing crack for school supplies. It was the only way he could get he could buy school supplies for himself and for his siblings. And we were treating him as if that was the equivalent of other people for whom we would give a 10-year sentence. We clearly have to undo that. We clearly have to reconsider this. And, you know, the it's just that this is an odd case in which to begin. So there are two tensions here. On the one hand is the tension to reduce sentences, and the other is the tension about equity. And you can't start reducing white-collar sentences to a proportional level unless you begin to think about what we do with poor people of color.
Yeah, we've talked to you before about kind of the mood in the country leading up to the 2016 election and this idea that a lot of folks feel that the deck is stacked against them and that folks who are wealthy or powerful basically have an advantage. If you, like you're saying, if you use this as a chance to start ratcheting down sentencing, what kind of message does that send to folks who are saying, hey, I'm not able to get a fair shake in this country?
Well, that's right. In researching this article, I found that one thing that this judge says, Judge Ellis said, which other judges say, is, you know, if you take certain actions, you have to accept the consequences. And he typically says that in a situation in which he is rejecting a defense that someone was woefully addicted and that's why they did the crime or that they had been abused as a child. Nevertheless, somehow, Paul Manafort didn't have to accept the consequences. Paul Manafort was looking at a very different kind of scene. So, yes, the beginning with white-collar sentences to reevaluate everything only works if we do it across the board, if we recognize that imprisonment is simply not the solution to crime, that imprisonment creates more disruption in communities than it solves.
So one final question before we let you go. I'm curious, you've said that you think judges need to have more discretion in order to kind of consider all the factors, and that makes a lot of sense. But I'm also worried about how you see kind of perception of the legal system. For example, in the Manafort case that we're talking about, you wrote in August about how this judge, T.S. Ellis, basically had stepped over the line, kind of asserting his own opinions. And how do you balance the perspective that our legal system needs to treat everyone fair, and if you're giving judges the discretion that some may have an opinion or a bias that plays into their judgments?
Well, you know, you have to step back again. That article was about the way he was conducting the trial, which was very different because he kept on injecting himself and disparaging the prosecution, which was extraordinary. At sentencing, though, the issue here is that there are lots of ways of that if you don't give judges some discretion, then the discretion goes to the prosecutor and it goes to the cops. And those decisions are less accountable and less controllable than those of a judge. When I, entered a decision, when I sentence someone, my sentence would be appealed. When the prosecutor decides to charge someone with a mandatory minimum that makes no sense, he cannot be appealed. That's the end of it, and he's determining the sentence. So we can't talk about judicial discretion until you talk about all the other players in the system. And there are ways of dealing with judicial discretion. There are appeals, there are reports, there are decisions, there are, you know, there's training, there's all sorts of ways of dealing with the very accountable and very public judges' decisions.
Well, that's Judge Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. And you can find a link to her op-ed for the Washington Post at our website, radioboston.org. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Sidorek, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. Here in Boston and in Massachusetts, it's pretty well documented that politically we lean to the left. Statewide, there are three times as many registered Democrats as there are Republicans. But does that mean we're politically intolerant of other viewpoints? According to a new study recently published in The Atlantic, Suffolk County may be the most politically intolerant county in the entire country. Data for the study was analyzed by PredictWise in an effort to determine whether some communities in America are demonstrably more or less politically forgiving than others. Amanda Ripley wrote about the findings for The Atlantic, and she joins us now. Hello, Amanda.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And listeners, we want to hear from you on this as well. How often do you find yourself in meaningful conversations with people from the other side of the aisle? Are you having a hard time dealing with people who disagree with you on issues like guns or immigration or climate change or President Trump? Do you buy the notion that Boston and Suffolk County are the most politically prejudiced in the country? And have political disagreements affected your relationships with family or friends? You can call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Amanda, Suffolk County, how did you guys determine that this is the most politically prejudiced place in the country?
Well, this all started because we wanted to do a story on political polarization, but we didn't want to just do another story lamenting how terrible it is. And we thought it might be interesting to see if we could find the outlier, find a place where people seem to be inexplicably still open-minded politically. And so we worked with PredictWise, and what they did was they started with a poll of 2,000 people across the country and asked them 14 questions about how they feel about the other side. So this is not about how you feel about the other side's policies or ideology, but, you know, do you think the term selfish is a good way to describe Democrats or Republicans? How would you feel if your child married someone who was a Democrat or a Republican? Those kinds of questions that help get at, imperfectly, but help get at how people feel about regular Americans who support a particular party. And then once we did that, we knew a huge amount about those 2,000 people. And what PredictWise does is some pretty complicated modeling to understand what makes these people similar and different from the other 300 million people in the country. And then doing that, we were able to see which demographic and geographic traits seem to correlate with political prejudice. And we found out, for example, that people who are white, people who are older, people who are educated, all these things seem to correlate with political intolerance in ways that were in some ways surprising, in other ways not. But maybe most interestingly to me is we saw that geographic political diversity in your neighborhood really matters. So people who have more political diversity in their neighborhood, which, for example, I do not because I live in Washington, D.C., which went 94% for Hillary Clinton. People who have more political diversity tend to be a little bit less likely to stereotype and demonize the other side.
So you yourself would admit, I think, that you guys, this is not perfect methodology. Basically, you're talking about 2,000 surveys and then assigning scores to more than 3,000 counties. Do you worry at all about kind of overgeneralizing, painting with a broad brush as you're putting this data out there?
Yeah, I mean, what we would like to do is survey 300 million Americans, which would be the right way to do that. And that would cost billions of dollars. So what was out there before was nothing. And so we took nothing. And we tried to drive the reporting based on some actual, you know, best guesses based on data. So instead of just parachuting into some town in Minnesota and saying, this place seems more politically open-minded and writing about, like, the guys at the diner, which is usually how these stories go, we decided to use the data to try to point me in the direction of a place that was unusual. And that's how I ended up focusing the story on a place in far upstate New York called Watertown, which we believe to be among the least politically prejudiced places in the United States. And then, you know, the question is to figure out, were we right? You know, to spend some time on the qualitative side of the equation and figure out, is our data actually pointing us in the right direction?
All right. Well, we are going to use that data right now to launch a conversation about this. So Amanda Ripley, contributing writer at The Atlantic and senior fellow at the Emerson Collective, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Joining us here in the studio is Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer Ed Lyons. Ed, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me back.
And also with us is Jordan Berg Powers, executive director for Mass Alliance, a coalition that advocates for progressive policies. Jordan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So let me start with just kind of a general reaction from both of you guys. Do you buy that Suffolk County is the most politically intolerant county in the country?
I would say it probably is, and it's something that we should be really proud of, just like we were about Nixon. I think that ultimately what we're saying is that we're intolerant of the idea that climate change isn't real, that black people's lives don't matter, and that immigrants should be in cages. And so the idea that we are intolerant of those things is something that I'm definitely proud of.
Ed, I'm going to guess you're going to push back on that.
No, I think I agree with Jordan on those particular issues. And actually, I lived in Boston for 20 years until very recently. I've been involved in politics inside Boston and around the state for a long time. I do think there is intolerance, but I'm uncomfortable saying it in the broad way. I don't really think it's about policy. I think it's more complicated than that. But, you know, I think, you know, we Republicans don't get to be the persecuted minority very much. So I've enjoyed this past week, everyone discussing our oppression. And I have all kinds of sob stories if you want to hear them, but I wouldn't recommend asking me.
All right. Well, listeners, don't forget you can jump in on this conversation as well. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The elephant in the room here, I think, so to speak, is Governor Charlie Baker. He's a Republican. If Massachusetts is so liberal and politically intolerant, how have we had so many Republican governors over the years?
I think that's complicated, and I think our politics has changed over time, and our national politics have changed, and the amount of nationalization in our politics has changed. I do think that Governor Baker winning Suffolk County and almost winning Boston on his third try does say something about what the model does and does not tell us. I think he won on likability, on paying respect to, you know, as Jordan was saying, certain issues about civil rights. So I do think that he managed to sort of hack the system that Amanda and her peers described in the article. And I do think that it's a good way to talk about what the model does and doesn't say.
Yeah, I actually want to go back to something Ed said earlier about the idea that Republicans are oppressed, which I think is the heart, actually, of this article, and the real dangerousness of using prejudice and words like prejudice to talk about something like this. I mean, prejudice is something we shouldn't use lightly to talk about people who have frankly, wrong ideological viewpoints. Who view certain people as inhuman. I don't think we should think of that as the same as black and brown folks, Latinx folks, people like myself, who have systematic oppression and systematic prejudice in our faces on a daily basis. So I think that, you know, ultimately this article really reflects the media's desire to have a story about partisanship rather than some of the deep roots and the deeper things that are actually going on in America. And Charlie Baker really is just a signal to that. It's not just as simple as R versus D.
Well, if you really dig down there, I think it's one thing if you're talking about folks to either extreme, but if you're talking about a more moderate Republican, do you still feel that that's an acceptable, if you don't want to use prejudice, tolerance for different political views? How do you have conversations with people if you're not willing to listen to their point of view?
I think, again, that's actually a really good point, and I think that that's also what gets missed in this conversation. Ultimately, what needs to happen is a conversation, but it doesn't mean we have to be tolerant of those viewpoints. So I think what's important is that we should always listen. We should always come with care. We should always not be ashamed to be made fun of for coming with facts and figures and the things that the left is often demonized for, but rather that we should feel free to come with those things, but also with an intellectual curiosity as to how people got where they are. And frankly, Charlie Baker has done that with people on the left, and that's why he's been so successful, is being able to bridge those things.
All right, I want to bring some callers in here. Don't forget, you can join us 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Susan from West Roxbury, you're on the line. Welcome, Susan. What's on your mind?
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. What is on my mind is I've lived in Boston for about 30 years, but I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania, and it's really uncomfortable to go back there sometimes because, especially since the last election, even college-educated people who might be more prone to read widely and understand the statistics, many of them voted for Trump, and I have nothing to say when they come up with what is clearly homophobic, anti-Semitic, closed-minded, narrow, and prejudicial statements to support why they chose to vote that way. And it's really interesting because Erie's a bellwether. It hadn't voted Republican since, I don't know, before John Kennedy. So I have relatives in other parts of the country as well who voted red this time and aren't usually voting that way. So I find it hard to believe that Suffolk County is more prejudiced than many people who won't speak to me in Erie because I have an Elizabeth Warren sticker on my car when I go to visit.
Yeah, Susan, it's an interesting question. So I think kind of coming out of that, how big is the Trump factor here? Because that, for a lot of folks, as she mentioned, it's not necessarily tried and true Republicans. Some folks who either hadn't voted before or who were maybe independents voted for Donald Trump. And that has been a very divisive issue for our country. How much do you think that factors in?
I think it's big. I think that this study talks about like demographic and cultural markers. I don't think everybody is necessarily disagreeing on specific policies. I think they're saying, I have shortcuts in my mind. You're religious or not religious. You're ex-urban versus urban. You're black versus white. I think that we put people in these categories and that we react to them. So me being a moderate Republican who's very educated, who, you know, agrees with a lot of the civil rights consensus, people think, oh, well, I can talk to you, even though they won't like my opinions on government unions or what to do about the Boston public school system or about occupational licensing, or I could list a zillion differences, how to run the MBTA. But yet, but because I sort of have these demographic and cultural markers that they'll listen to me, where if I didn't have certain markers, they would not listen to me, even if I didn't have radically different views. So I do think that we have to be careful about why we're disagreeing. I don't really think it's about policy, even though we can cite dramatic policy differences that come to us from our television screens.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually the article itself talks about, from Lillian Mason, talks about the fact that Americans are really divided in terms of their identity. And so really Trump has just surfaced some of the white supremacy that's been hidden for years that the that the Republican Party has whistled at. He's been more open to talk about it. And so those things are surfacing in new and ways that are hard for people to sort of grapple with, talk about. Much to the caller, I'm actually from originally, my family in rural Pennsylvania. I go home to rural Pennsylvania myself, outside of Lehigh Valley. And I would just encourage, I actually went out and made sure to talk to all my family members who voted for Trump, because I really wanted to make sure that they understood that there was something really insidious at the heart of that vote.
How did those conversations go?
They were tough, but they knew that I came from them loving them, that I would love them from the beginning, I'd love them at the end. And ultimately, they might not, I don't think they're progressives. I don't think by any stretch they've come to some sort of enlightenment, but they see some of the troubling conversations and they'll bring those to light when we see them coming off. Like, oh, Jordan, I really didn't like that he said those things about those people or these people. So I do think that there are opportunities when you come at people and have conversations from love.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned having those conversations. Amanda Ripley, the writer for The Atlantic, I know, wrote about this idea that the more isolated you are, the less you talk to people with different views, the more likely you are to be intolerant of other views. Ed, as a Republican here in Massachusetts, have you found that folks are able to have honest intellectual conversations with you, or do you feel kind of dismissed out the gate?
Well, I really am a really weird Republican, so I don't think that I can talk about what everybody's experiencing.
Fair enough.
I do think they're Republicans.
I'm sure you have some friends who can speak to it.
Yeah. I do think the Republicans, what's interesting about this study was the Republicans in Boston were more reasonable than Republicans in other parts of the state. I thought that was really interesting. I think I know why. I think it's because a lot of Republicans in Boston buy into certain things. So Anthony Amore, a Republican, a friend of mine who ran for Secretary of State, because he worked at the Gardner Museum and because he like lives a life of the mind, that people sort of like put their guard down and say, oh, okay, you work at the Gardner Museum. Okay, well, you're not one of those people. And they would listen, even though he said, I want show ID to vote, which people here don't want. But what I meant is because he had these cultural markers that the conversation began, where if he was some guy with a pickup truck, they'd be like, well, I'm not talking to you. So I do think we have to be careful. And that can even happen inside the Democratic Party. I watched the fractured communities around the Boston 2024 Olympics. I do think there are all these factors involved that are not policy. I do think even aside from how we're treated as Republicans in this area, I think the Democrats can be closed-minded to all kinds of things because they lack these markers, even inside their own party.
I want to go back to the phones. Dave from Concord is on the line. Dave, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, so I actually don't think that there is an intolerance of political agreement here. I think it's more about factual items, because if you look at how the facts are presented, for instance, you think about climate change, and the Republican Party in general is against spending money on climate change. And that's something that scientifically is proven as a fact, yet our president denies that that's actually something that's happening. So I think what's happening is in the most educated areas is that you're getting people who disagree on the facts, and therefore, as a result of that, they end up switching to their parties, where the Democrats tend to lean towards the scientific side of the house and things like that, and the Republicans tend not to.
Yeah, interesting point, Dave. Ed, I know you said you're kind of a unique Republican here, but it's still your party. How do you see the way your party deals with something like climate change, where science is pretty well settled on that?
Well, until very recently, there's now a majority of Republicans to support that the idea that climate change is real and that humans are causing it. I do think that President Trump is sort of pushing people in the other direction. But in general, I mean, under the age of 40, most Republicans I know believe in man-made climate change and they want something done about it. And Governor Baker is starting to lead on this issue. So I do think that's changing a little bit. But I think he's right that climate change has become one of these like tribal cultural issues where they're not really interested in learning about climatology and ice cores and carbon isotopes and all those things. What they're really saying is, oh, our side believes this and your side believes that. And that becomes one of the battlegrounds. But I don't think Republicans have problems in Boston because they don't believe in climate change. I think it is about the demographic and culture markers in this study and not about my position about greenhouse gases.
So I want to go a listener on Twitter. Susan S. Flagg is tweeting, two of my adult children refuse to follow me on Facebook due to our different political views. We still chat and all, but veer away from touchy subject. And then she throws in, they are Trumpettes. I'm just curious, in the time we have left, so much of this conversation, I think, comes down to dehumanization of the others, basically. How do you kind of see that in, you know, about 30 seconds here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is that the core of the modern Republican Party and the conservative movement is the dehumanization of people who aren't white. And so fundamentally what this study is really surfacing is a lot of that intolerance. And so I think that, you know, it's easy to say like there's cultural markers around it, but fundamentally, you know, we have parties who are saying trans people aren't people, black people should be, you know, think about their interactions, Latinos should be treated differently, people should be in cages. There's a real dehumanization of a lot of Americans going on. And so there's obviously a necessary reaction to that that's equally as feeling like I'm not sure about that. And I do think you should have to prove that you don't believe those things because those are all horrible things to believe.
All right. Well, Ed, we'll have to give you the last word next time you come back. That's Jordan Berg Powers, Executive Director for Mass Alliance, a coalition for political progressive policies, and Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thank you both so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zuckoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.